Hello, everyone. And if there are any questions or thoughts about any of that, yes, Sarah.
This is from actually a couple weeks ago. This is regarding animals again, and just wondering about consciousness of animals that do, like a seeing eye dog or ones that do rescue. Would you think that their consciousness might be a little higher than the regular person?
Well, it would have to be. I mean, how could it not be? You know, a couple of weeks ago we talked all about seeing eye dogs and animals. I mean, about animals and they would have to be because, number one, they're in tremendous association with people. They receive an education from people. They spend their whole life serving people. They would get good karma for doing it, but they would have to have very, very good karma already just to have a life like that. Because think about the whole experience that they're having. I wrote the monthly letter this month was all about animals. If you haven't read it yet, you might enjoy it. It was like an extension of this class. It was a lot of fun to write it. But one thing that occurred to me when I was writing that was just how really dull an animal's life is in the wild. We think about what, you know, how great it is for them to be in the wild, but all they do then is hunt, sleep, reproduce, and run away from other things that are trying to eat them. I mean, nothing of interest ever happens. They never go on car trips. They never, you know, they never go to interesting sites. They don't visit foreign countries. They don't meet children. They just don't, they just hang out. We think it's so great. But really, you know, there's so many, somewhere in the Gita, we haven't gotten to it yet, it has that phrase, what's day to the worldly man is night to the yogi. What's night to the worldly man is day to the yogi. It has the obvious explanation that while everyone else is at work, everyone else is sleeping, the yogi is meditating. But on a much more profound level, it means once you make self-realization your goal, many things flip over. And it's extremely important on the spiritual path to stop and ask yourself whether or not certain ideas that we hold are just our habit to hold them, or even worse than that, a sentimental attachment to holding them. Because this is the way I've always thought, you know. There's a friend of mine who was a very liberal political activist, and, you know, just when certain subjects come up, he just goes there. And it doesn't hold water with anything, many things that Master said, or I'm not talking, last week we talked about Cesar Chavez and Martin Luther King, I'm not talking about that, but just this kind of sentimental attachment to a certain point of view. One of the sentimental attachments we have is that how wonderful it is to leave animals in the wild. But really, how do they progress spiritually in the wild? Nothing happens to them. It's so much better for them to be with people for all the reasons that we talked about before. And I'm using that as an example of just don't let your mind just go into habits just because that's what you're thinking. So yes, for those dogs to get to live interesting lives, travel to exciting places, do serviceful things, save people's lives, that's marvelous. Or help a person accomplish what they need to accomplish by being with them, being the recipient of such devotion and gratitude. All of that is wonderful for them. This morning I was, we have a little pond, almost all of you have seen our backyard, we have a little pond there, and of the 50 cats that live in our community, a number of them come over to the pond and they'll drink. And they drink just like little lions. You know, they get down and their little haunches are way up in the air and they're just crouched, just like pictures that you see of animals in the wild at the watering hole. I came out this morning to energize on the deck, which is about 8 or 10 feet away from there. And I came out very quietly. I just finished meditating and I was just about to start. And that poor little cat just froze because this huge living being had arisen up behind it, you know, and its little haunches were there, and very slowly it turns its face around like this. And I suddenly realized that the threat was me. And I just sort of, you know, he looked really scared. Really, I don't know who he was, but I saw him being chased by one of the Madison cats later, so he must be the cat, he must be the scape cat, is what I was calling him of the area. But, you know, and then he very stealthily crept away and hid in the grass, and then he made his way, I just was energizing, he made his way all the way around, and at a certain point I looked at him and he froze. You know what I thought? I thought, boy, an animal's life is really overrated. I mean, it's hunger, it's hunger, thirst, fear, and occasional safety and sleep. I mean, for the most part, I understand, and as I wrote in my letter, that if they're pets, there can also be a lot of communication with their person. But in actual fact, the life of an animal has a very limited scope because the nervous system of that animal just isn't capable of doing a lot more. And a great deal of the time, it can't What was the earth was that for? Oh, it was hers. It was Sarah's. A great deal of the time, that wakes us up, doesn't it? A great deal of the time, it can't comprehend. I was telling Swami that story, and he said, but the cat lives with people all the time. Couldn't it tell that you were a person? I mean, why, you know, it's never been hurt by people, but I was there, and it just didn't have the capacity to abstract reason. I don't think this is the most intelligent cat in the community. I have to say that even among cats, it looked much more feline than many of them. Many of them have a much more living intelligence in them. This one did not. But, you know, he's seen thousands and thousands of people. And I'm sure very rarely does a person hurt him. But there it was. His mind couldn't protect him from that thought. Anyway, so yes. Any other questions? Yes, Tony.
Last week you were talking about the Ananda way, and you know, from an outsider's perspective, it might be misconstrued as, you know, being part of a cult. And I, you know, thought about it, and the difference between blind obedience, mm-hmm. like, you know, Jonestown, mm-hmm. Other cults that we've, you know, heard about, is, you know, the conscious choice as well as attunement. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we don't have the discrimination to know the difference
between a cult and
not so much as an occult, but sometimes we don't know if we're in attunement.
Oh yes.
And can you comment on, you know, about what one does? I guess I don't do something until I'm really sure, but rarely is it that I'm positive about, you know, mm-hmm. if it's the right thing.
Right, that's a very good question. Well, I don't have to repeat it. It was recorded. Okay. The thought form is, it's like, because being part of a group of people who share your ideals bears a certain resemblance to being a mindless member of a mindless entity, there's that anxiety. That's one aspect. And the other is, how do you just tell if you're in tune? You know, it's a strange quality. I was talking to Swamiji about this over the last few days. Americans are so suspicious, just incredibly suspicious, and we're very suspicious. We're very suspicious with our minds. We have this tremendous commitment to this mind's capacity to figure it out. But you see, inherently, the mind can't figure it out. That's sort of what you're saying. It's like the mind wants to be sure. The mind wants to have it all figured out and then know what's right. But by definition, the mind can't do that because you cannot have certainty just by trying to reason it out. So the very commitment to needing to sort of reason it out and be sure with the mind makes us very, very insecure because we can never be sure that way. The only way you can really be sure about anything is when you calm the mind sufficiently to also be able to feel the intuition of the heart. Calm feeling. And calm feeling is, I mean, when you fall in love with someone, and let's assume that, I mean, on a more uplifted and refined level, not just a mere physical attraction or an infatuation, but you really meet a dear friend. There's just some understanding that this is a dear friend to me. And it's not necessarily that you can exactly say why they're a dear friend and what makes them a dear friend. You just know that they are. The first person from Ananda that I got to know as a friend was Nalini, who's still at the village now. And it was very interesting to me because she was sort of like the first member of the spiritual family that I met who I just knew that she was a dear friend of mine from past lives. Our personalities were not similar. Our interests were not particularly similar, although we do have certain things in common. But I remember saying to myself at the time, I would do anything for this woman. I hardly know her. But I just knew that she was a dear friend of mine, and it's always proved true. You know, we've had times when we've been closer than not close, but there's always been this very deep connectedness between us. And it doesn't make any sense. It's not reasonable, but I didn't have to be reasonable. I just knew it. There was no jeopardy. There was no threat in that. So I didn't have to worry about, there's this quality that I see also in Americans a great deal, which is we really want to be thought both astute and shrewd. We're extremely worried about later on having been proved to have been naive and a little foolish. And because of that, we miss so many opportunities because we're so busy being careful that we can to be thought shrewd and clever and not at all gullible that we just hold ourselves back from so much. I've sort of, all my life I've been, shrewd is not the word, but I've tended to be critical and too analytical. Swamiji finally sort of gave a bit of advice. He said, you know, why not just be positive and accepting about people? This was in a completely other context, but I heard him say this. Why not just be positive and accepting time enough later to see them realistically if you need to? It was just such an interesting way to think of it. You know, if you need to see them as they really are later on, then you will. But until then, why not just be accepting and happy? Why not be naive? If it's just a conscious choice, I think I'll just be open-hearted and naive. Because one can always be shrewd later if you need to be. But you see how much sweeter it is to live that way? Give them the benefit of the doubt. More than that, give yourself the benefit of the doubt. Right in our reading today, just to go right to our chapter, Swamiji says, even a gray tinge of criticism gradually grays your own consciousness. And a very critical attitude, the dark critical attitude, just darkens your whole consciousness. So we spend so much of our life with that gray tinge of criticism, really on the basis of wanting to be thought shrewd and not later having people be able to say, how could you be taken in? And I'd much rather say, I don't know, I just was, than always be so careful to make sure nobody takes advantage of you. That's why I've had much less experience than Swami, but that's why teaching in America is such a drag compared to teaching in Italy or teaching in India. Because all the Americans are sitting with their arms folded waiting for you to prove that you're not a fraud. Whereas in India, they don't have that same... See, this is cultural. This is what you have to realize. This is just exactly what I was saying about the animals in the wild. This is a cultural characteristic of the American commitment to being clever. Because it's so important to us to be clever. Whereas in Italy, for example, I've watched, like the reception line that was here on a Sunday night. There were a few Italians in that line, but not as many as there sometimes are. But every time Italians will come up to Swamiji, especially when he's been speaking English and then he'll start speaking Italian, he'll speak English in this way, and he'll always start laughing when he starts speaking Italian. Just for no reason. He just starts sort of laughing a little, and they laugh a little, and they don't use a lot of words. I can tell what they're saying to each other. They're saying things like, oh, bella, bellissima, bella, you know, the gioia, gioia, and they're not saying anything to each other. They're just passing these vibes back and forth. It's all just from the heart. I mean, the people are absolutely intelligent and educated. It's just not such a value with them to be shrewd. And so the whole concept that you're raising is a very American concept. This anxiety a little bit about, now you're not worried about whether you're in a cult or not. So to your real question is how can you tell when you're in tune? Swamiji says the infallible sign of attunement is joy. When someone asked him that question, how can I tell if I'm in tune? He said, when no matter what happens, you feel this deep undercurrent of joy. And he didn't mean that you're giggling all the time. He just meant that your inner reality is sufficiently in tune, connected, however you want to say it, with the flow of spirit, that everything else that happens above that foundation of joy. And to whatever extent we don't have that foundation of joy, that's the degree of our lack of attunement. And you see, that kind of attunement is not about anything specific. It's just about having an anchor to our mind that constantly goes back. You know, Swamiji said something so beautiful on Sunday night. He said, I will always be in your hearts. He said that when he goes, when he leaves the country and when he leaves the planet. And he said it with a great deal of force. I will always be in your hearts. I have to say, I moved away from Swamiji 20 years ago. I haven't lived in the same community that Swamiji has lived in for 20 years. It's true that living here is not that far from where he's lived because we have the international airport. He comes through a lot. Out of kindness, he's made a point of visiting us a lot. When we had all that legal trouble, a lot of it happened here. I mean, that we just, he's been in our house even for weeks at a time. So even though I haven't lived in the same community, I have never been even in a physical way out of touch. And there's, of course, telephones. You know, we talk regularly. For the first couple of years that I was here, I felt utterly bereft. And I felt left out. I mean, the whole life I had been living at the village was going on. I didn't work for Swamiji anymore, and I hadn't, and I didn't see him on the same daily basis. But nonetheless, to be in the same community he was in brought me into his physical orbit a lot more than it did here. And every time he'd come to visit, when he'd leave, I would just fall apart. I mean, every time when he would leave, I would weep and weep, and they weren't tears of joy. They were just tears of utter bereavement. And then, after about 2 years, I tell people it takes 2 years to change communities. If you've lived in a community for a long time and you change, it takes about 2 years before you let go of your old home and move into your new home. And I did it. It took me 2 years, too. I didn't even think about it until just this minute. But one day I thought, it occurred to me that if I bailed out of this situation because I wanted to be where Swami was, if I asserted my own will against what God had asked me to do, I wouldn't be happy anyway. That the thought that I would be happier somewhere else because I had been happy there was totally a dream. Now, bear in mind, it's not that change is not a good idea, but in my circumstances, the karmic responsibility was so obvious, which it is in many of our lives. I mean, in your life too, your karmic responsibilities have taken visible form. You know, so you are where you're supposed to be, and yet the mind imagines it would be happier if. And I thought to myself, you'll never be happy just going with your own will. You have to follow the divine will. And the moment I realized that that my justification for being unhappy, in my particular case, I want to be very specific, because sometimes you should jettison your circumstances. It's the divine call to jettison them. But in my circumstances, it wasn't. I thought, I'll never be happy if I go against this, even if I'm, quote, back with Swami. I don't want to overstate this, but from that point, I haven't missed him. I mean, I love his company. You see me, I just completely... I mean, when he went, I thought later, he went and sat on the stage, and I just went and sat right next to him. Much later, I thought, I didn't even think about that. It was just, he was sitting there, and I just went and sat with him. I just do that wherever he is. I just follow him. So it's not like I'm indifferent to his physical company, but when it becomes impossible, he always lives in our heart. Now, that's that for me, because he's the personification of Master to me, that's attunement for me. I think it helps if you can focus on something specific, and his consciousness is very available. If you draw it, it's very available. Master's consciousness is available. Swami's consciousness is available. So what you need to do is really quite simple, which is just not think that you're alone. That's all attunement is to realize that you're not alone, that you're not really running the show from your ego. Was that what I talked about on Sunday? I think that was a little bit of Sunday's sermon. It was something I talked about recently. I was talking about that. To actually imagine, I mean, where do you end and the rest of the reality begins? It's just a seamless whole. And yet what we do, and this is in our chapter today too, I'm talking so much, but it's right here. All of desire starts with the ego, which is the soul identified with the body, which gives us the illusion of separateness and creates within us a profound sense of being incomplete. Because as soon as we are in a physical body, we're mortal, We're apparently separate. We're vulnerable in so many different ways. And more than that, to be in a physical body is to embrace the identity with the ego for all of us until we become jivanmuktas. And as long as we've embraced the identity with the ego, then to that extent we feel separate and therefore incomplete. And attunement is just all those practices that remind us continuously that we appear to be alone, but we are not. That was a lot of what Swami said on Sunday night. You have to realize, he was saying, God is with you just as you are. You don't have to earn it. You're not terrible. You don't have to wait till you're good enough. You don't have to wait for anything. You are not alone. Now, you see, once you have that, that's where Swamiji says the sign, you know, the infallible sign of attunement is joy. If you have, you know, the saint, the guru, the teacher always in your heart, what could make you unhappy? You see, that's what I've learned, which not all of you have had this opportunity, but I can pass on the lesson at least. That's what I've learned from my time, the time I've spent with Swamiji, which is the lessons that I've had explicitly from him have taught me lessons that are not, that don't require his presence to practice. When I'm in his company, in any circumstance, I never want to be anywhere else. I never think that I should be somewhere else. And it's not merely that I'm where I should be. There's such contentment where he's standing that what I get from him is this sense of, wherever you are, why would you be anxious to be somewhere else? And so from having that experience with him of just calm acceptance of wherever I'm standing, when I'm not with him, I think, why would I feel different now? What has changed? And that, all of that is the process of attunement. You're attuning yourself to a different level of reality. It's the level of reality that is real, and therefore on which you don't feel incomplete. And therefore you don't feel restless. And therefore whatever happens up or down, it doesn't touch your joy. Even if what happens touches your heart so deeply that you weep. You know, if a child dies, you're not going to be happy the whole time. If you just see so many unspeakable tragedies in this world, you can't just laugh at them. This brings us absolutely right into the center of what we're studying right now. There's this, I was opening my notebook just to get it. There's this extraordinary passage that Swami talks about where he says, I love the fact that it's all coming down to attunement, because that's all there ever is. Everything is attunement. Swami was describing how, you know, the perception, as he puts it, perception depends on the power to perceive. It's one of those sentences you have to sit with for a little while, which is to say there's no objective reality out there. It all depends on your capacity to perceive it, your orientation when you perceive it. Just this afternoon, I was with someone, and it was one of those, I was with someone who was very, very open-hearted and accepting, and this individual was behaving in a certain way that I thought was slightly obnoxious and a little bit foolish, despite my resolution that I just spoke. And someone said to me, oh, isn't so-and-so just wonderful in the way they do? And I had just, in my mind, been thinking, what an incompetent person. And that other person just thought they were wonderful. We were looking at exactly the same thing. You know, neither of us, it was a total stranger, neither of us had any other input. We had exactly the same input. So it's just the power of the intellect and the mind to, you know, filter the information, and who's to say who was right or who was wrong? You know, my habit of mind is to analyze and to be a little critical, and this person's habit of mind is to just take people as they are and be more accepting. I kind of think I was wrong. I think objectively their analysis was not accurate, but I also think I was wrong. So Swami says it depends on the our inner power to perceive, as he put it. And so then he talks about, well, what happens when you perceive ugliness? Because even though one wants to be open-hearted, there are just really awful things in this world. You know, people's lives, so many people's lives are tragic. As old as I am now, and having had the same group of friends for almost 40 years, and some of them have wandered off into other ways of life, and sometimes you see what's become of people from what they were when I knew them when they were young, it just breaks my heart to see where people's lives have gone. So you can't, the Swami says, you can't just close your eyes and really become foolish and pretend it's not there. Oh, isn't it wonderful? I saw so-and-so, and they were living on the street out of a garbage can, and it was so sweet. You know, it isn't. It's heartbreaking. Or so-and-so used to be so devoted to God, but now they've just become so worldly, and they look so sad, which is specifically what I was dealing with lately. You know, so-and-so used to be so full of devotion. These are people you don't know, but as I say, over 40 years, so-and-so used to be so full of devotion and had so much love for God, and then just tumbled out and turned away from the path, and now their lives are so sad. But what he says is, because perception depends on your inner power, you can always withdraw into your inner self and reconnect with that level of reality which transcends the changing world that you're seeing. And then what Swamiji says, as he puts it, is he said, then you project out onto whatever you're seeing that aura of bliss that's inside of you. And it's not even so much that you're trying to help them, it's that you're just trying to see the world through that lens. And so the person may still be as sad and as tragic as they ever were, but it's also just a wave on the ocean. And you can live under the wave with your own perception of people. When I saw Danyan Brinkley there's a phrase called a Choto Guru, which is just a small guru to you, not a Sat Guru, but a Choto Guru. Danyan Brinkley, who wrote that book, Saved by the Light, and he was a really interesting character. Some of you may remember, we had him come and speak at the church here. It was a night to remember. He was a very different kind of man. He'd had all these after-death experiences and return, death and return. He'd been an assassin for the CIA. And that was his job. He was a very odd man. And then he was struck by lightning, and then he had this incredible, all these visions of the other worlds, and then he just changed his life completely. He, more than anyone I'd met up until that time, was absolutely afraid of no one. And I don't just mean he wasn't afraid because he'd been an assassin and he was a strong man. He was not afraid to allow anybody's vibrations to enter anybody's vibrations or let those vibrations come into him. And he just related to people in a way I just had never really seen before. Street people, old people, everybody. He was just fearless. I think after all he'd been through, nothing disturbed him. And he just related to them all with this great inner bliss. I mean, of course, that's how Swami is and others. But Danyan was such a character, and he just interacted and acted with people. I remember in the middle of the lecture, somebody got up to go to the bathroom. There were a few hundred people, remember? Where are you going? He said. She said, I'm just going to the bathroom. Fortunately, the girl was quite, you know, cheeky. I'm just going to the bathroom. I intend to come back. Well, you better come back, he said. You can go, but you better come back. I mean, just stopped everything. And it all just felt perfectly natural. There was just no, he was seamless in his reality. Also, we brought him into the minister's room. He'd never met Swami before, but Swami had read his book and really liked him. He walked in, he saw Swami's picture. He immediately sensed it. He said, where is this guy? I said, well, he's at his home at the village. He said, this is his place. I can't speak without his permission. He said, we need to telephone him. I said, okay, you know. So I just dialed Swami's number. I said, Swami, Danyan Brinkley's here. He won't talk until he gets your permission, you know. And they chatted a little bit, and then he had his permission. He was fine. But just, and then I read this. Everything that you perceive is dependent upon the power with which you perceive it. Now, this is also, some of you have heard me say this, but this is a very interesting reversal of an attitude I've had about myself in life until just a few years ago. And it's one of those, again, commonly held but false ideas. Because I made myself to have sort of a small body, and I'm very Cancerian, and I have lots of intuitive feelings about things, and I just have all this stuff going on all the time. And I've always liked that, you know? I've never seen myself as stalwart, even though I'm quite forceful. But kind of underneath it, my actual self-image has been a little delicate. Very, very sensitive, definitely very sensitive. You know, and just some things are just too much. And I always thought that was a virtue. You know, you just sort of think of it like that, like it's refinement or something like that. And as I told some of you, it was sitting next to Robert and having him do this affirmation. I mean, you can see Robert from the get-go had a very different concept, you know, about everything. You know, he made himself a man, he made himself a big man, he made himself strong with this big voice. And, you know, his approach to life is just different. It's not that he doesn't perceive in the same way, but his concept was different. And that was the first time it occurred to me that my concept is really wrong. That the more sensitive you are, the more powerful you should be. Because then you need to draw in that inner energy and be strong in the face of what comes. I don't mean harsh or overbearing, but it is not a virtue to be delicate. That's what Master says too. Master puts it, don't baby yourself too much, he said. Be tough. Then he tells that incredible story. Well, Swami tells this in Conversations, I think it is. Maybe it's a different one. He talks about, Master told this story about this young boy that he knew whose mother used to beat him. And the boy somehow climbed a tree and slipped on the tree and just tore the flesh off his upper body. And the boy said, oh, just cover it up. Just put the shirt back on. You know, if my mom sees me, she's going to beat me. But it was just, it wasn't like, now everyone thinks about that, oh, that's a horrible story. But Master told that story as a positive thing. You know, so what if you've scratched your whole body up? Just put your shirt back on and go on. You see how different that is? And nowadays, because everything is so much about pleasure and having it your way, everything is having it exactly your way. You can just get everything custom-made just for you, just to order a coffee, you know. You can get it just exactly the way you want it. Everything is custom-made for personal pleasure. What is day to the yogi? It's night to the worldly man. What's day to the worldly man is night to the yogi. What we really need to be is so much in our inner bliss that it doesn't make any difference. And when we do begin to waffle, instead of delicately withdrawing, withdraw with power back into our inner bliss and then flood the world. Perception depends on the power to perceive. It's all dependent on how we're oriented within ourselves. And yes, at the same time, don't be foolish. And this is where I was saying a minute ago, by no means is endurance always the right answer. Because we also have to, and this is what Swami spoke of so powerfully, we have to have a very healthy respect for the capacity of delusion to take us away from the spiritual path again and again and again. So I'm not talking about playing with desires or playing with delusion. You know, we need to protect ourselves spiritually as much as possible, but the attitude we have toward life is one of inner strength. Do you understand the difference? I mean, to be worldly, to expose ourselves to worldly things, to deliberately put ourselves in the face of temptation, that is foolish, because it just, you know, no one can swear that they're not going to reawaken some samskara or another. I pick up this teacup now. I remember the household that I grew up in as a child. We weren't poor by any means, but my parents were not at all materialistic, and pretty much everything in the house was functional. They weren't into getting really expensive or beautiful things. It wasn't their interest. And so it wasn't until I was at Ananda, I was at with Swamiji at someone's house, and they served us tea in these little delicate china cups. And I had never actually drunk tea out of a delicate china cup in my life. It had just never come to pass. And I picked up the cup, and I put it against my lips. Now, this cup is about 3/4 of an inch thick. You know, it's just a cup. And there was this sensation of that delicate little china cup on my lips. And I said, oh, I see why people do this. It's very nice to drink out of such a delicate cup. Swami says, Master always said, be careful. He said, before you're a yogi, you've always been through a great deal of wealth. Because you don't really, you're not willing to give up that kind of wealth and comfort until you've had the satisfaction of it. It's only after you've had it, and he means past lives, You've been there, you've done that, you know that there's no satisfaction there. He said, but those samskaras can be very easily awakened. It was very interesting. I mean, maybe he was talking just to me, he was talking in principle, but he was also saying, don't indulge it. Don't try to have that. Interesting, eh? So that's what I mean. It's just like everything affects your consciousness. You asked the question about attunement, too. Just like, watch what you take in. Watch what you take in from the radio and the television and the books and the movies. I mean, we live in a mixed society, and I mean, most of us find it impossible to be entirely strict. I would love to be stricter in my life than I actually am. I find myself, I was joking with Swamiji about something or another, and I finally simply said, sir, I've lived in Palo Alto for 20 years, I've lowered my standards. What can I say? I've lowered my standards. I've just been here so long. He said, yes, it's kind of a spiritual wasteland, was the words he used. The spiritual boondocks is what we called it once. I mean, it's wonderful because of all of you and all of us. And in that sense, it's a magnificent area. But really, if you go beyond this, it's not gross. That almost makes it worse. But it's so incredibly designed for pleasure and for personal aggrandizement. You know, just like I was saying, to the absolute nth degree, you can just, that's how I always would tell our friends from the village, they'd come down here, I said, well, what do you want? Food, clothes, you know, art, anything. Anything on the material plane is probably available within 10 minutes of where we live. And it almost always is. And in a way, that's worse, because it's nicer. I'd much rather live in a refined area like this than, I grew up in El Paso, Texas. Boy, talk about the spiritual boondocks. Mamma mia. You know, it was really, I didn't know about consciousness until I left there and landed in California. I mean, there was no consciousness. I landed in California, and all of a sudden, it was like I woke up from this deep, dark sleep. So it's far better to be here. But don't mess with it, ever. Don't think that Maya won't get you. That's how it gets you over and over. That's what Swami said to all of us on Sunday. Yeah. Okay, that was a long answer to your question, but I went into the chapter. Anything else? I should read the Gita. Okay, we're actually finishing this chapter, which is called Freedom Through Action, which is considered to be the chapter about karma yoga in the Gita. So it's chapter 15 of the book, and we're still in chapter 3 of the Gita. That's what people call this. Thus ends the third chapter called Karma Yoga, because the Gita is all about how to act in the world. Okay, 325. O descendant of Bharata, Arjuna, as foolish people act out of attachment to ego in hope of rewards, so should the wise also act, even if wisdom has lifted them out of any personal need to be active. With dispassion and non-attachment, in glad service to others as their guides on the path of enlightenment. 326. Never should the wise condemn the ignorant for the ego motivation they manifest. Instead, being themselves enlightened, they should seek only to inspire others in the direction of preferring to perform right, dutiful action. Isn't that wonderful? That's what Swamiji always says. You can't really tell people what to do. People will only follow what they consider to make them happy. So you have to inspire people to realize that it's preferable. That's how Swami behaves. You know, on Sunday when we were here, which almost all of you were here, or all of you were here, he just created such an uplifted atmosphere that you compare that to other choices, and you just prefer it. It's as simple as that. Then the memory fades a little bit, and we start eating stale cheese, and we think it tastes good. And then we have, that's why it's better to come every Sunday, at least. 327. The universal impulse toward activity springs from the three gunas, or qualities of nature. Man, however, deluded by egoism, thinks, I am the doer. We're moved by the forces of this world, but we think we're acting out of free will. What a joke. 328. O Arjuna, he who understands how the gunas work in human nature and who knows, therefore, that even what the senses perceive depends on their indwelling power of perception, withdraws his mind and removes his attachment to things at the very source of his perception. Amazing, isn't it? You can see why people study the Gita for a whole lifetime. 329. The man of perfect wisdom should not bewilder the ignorant with his higher perception of the nature of reality. He should bear in mind that, deluded as they are by the gunas, they have no choice but to act under that influence. 330. Offer to me your every deed, devoid of egotism and desire, inwardly centered in the soul, ever calm and free from worries, be dutifully engaged in the battle of life. 331. True devotees, focused on practicing my precepts and the true teachings of others, achieve freedom from all karma. 332. Those, however, who scoff at this teaching of mind and refuse to practice it, deluded by ego as to the nature of wisdom, no such persons in their rejection due to ignorance to be courting doom. 333. Even the wise act according to the dictates of their own nature. All living beings obey the dictates of nature. Of what avail would be mere suppression? We'll come back to that one. 334. Attraction and repulsion regarding sense objects belong to the natural ebb and flow of duality. Beware of them both equally, for they are man's greatest enemies. 335. To do one's own duty, even unsuccessfully, is better than to do someone else's duty successfully. It is better to die while trying to accomplish one's own duty than to settle for another's duty, though safer and easier, which course is filled with danger and uncertainty. 336. Arjuna said, O Krishna, by what is one impelled even against his will to do wrong as if he were being forced to do so? 337. Krishna replied, it is desire, it is anger, both of which are impelled by Rajoguna. Know these to be mankind's greatest enemies. 338. As fire is obscured by smoke, as a mirror is covered by dust, as an embryo is enveloped by the womb, so is human understanding obscured by the three qualities, meaning the gunas. 339. O son of Kunti, Arjuna, the constant enemy of the wise are his unquenchable flames of inner desire. 340. The senses, mind, and intellect are declared to be their stronghold. Desire through these three deludes the embodied soul and eclipses its wisdom. 341. Therefore, O best of the Bharata dynasty, begin by disciplining the senses, withdrawing your energy from them into the spine. Then destroy desire by casting it from your heart. Desire is the sinful destroyer of wisdom and of self-realization. 342. The senses are declared to be superior to the body, since they convey perception. The mind is superior to the senses, both inner and outer, since it is the perceiver. The discriminating intellect is superior to the mind, since it understands what it perceives. And the self is superior to the discriminating intellect, since it is both perception and understanding. 343. O mighty armed Arjuna, thus cognizing the indwelling divine self as superior to intellectual understanding, discipline your lower self, the ego, by dwelling in the true self, and thereby overcome the foe who, wearing the armor of desire, is ever difficult to conquer. Thus ends the third chapter called Karma Yoga of the Upanishad of the Holy Bhagavad Gita, in the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna, discussing yoga and the science of self-realization. Wow, aren't those great verses? Just coming back for a moment, Tony, to your question about knowing what's right. So for some reason, that subject came up with Swamiji in discussion, and he was talking about just when I was telling him about people are afraid to not be thought astute. And he just said, what an unfortunate concern. He said, and he talked about this on Sunday night too, he said how he used to use his mind to make false reasoning. Just, he said it was like an instinctive self-protective thing he did. He showed how the mind can support any thought that you want. He said even from a very young age, he would never accept anything as true unless he could feel also in his heart that it was true. And he said very interestingly, yeah, how did this come up? He was talking about just from a very young age, he saw the limits of the mind to understand and always followed a balanced course of his own intuitive feeling about things. So that when he read Autobiography of a Yogi and it just felt absolutely true to him, he never had any doubt and he never looked back because he could balance out those two factors because he trained himself so long to do it. In another circumstance, Swami made the comment, he was working with someone else and this is what he said. He said that that person hasn't had as much experience following his heart as I have. He said, I feel perfectly confident and willing to go forward. But this other person whose cooperation he needed wasn't as experienced following the heart. See, this is this interesting characteristic of Swamiji. And this is a lot of what our chapters are about. So I wrote this in the book. After I thought about Swamiji the first time I saw him, the very first meeting, in the first 30 seconds when I said, he has what I want. That was not an intellectual thought. That was the vibration of his heart touched my heart and my heart responded that I just knew that whatever that vibration was. Then after he spoke, not one word of which I remember, I thought, this is the most intelligent man I have ever met. So it was a very interesting blend of those two realities because I was very intellectual and I had a tremendous, I have too much respect for intelligence. You know, intelligence itself looks like a virtue to me. Intelligence is nothing. Wisdom is the virtue. But I love intelligence. And so I saw he was so intelligent, and this is the most intelligent man I ever met. And then I started really learning from him. And I mean, he could just think circles around me. I was no small potato in many circles, but I was just a piece of grass next to him. You know, I couldn't think straight at all about anything. I gradually learned in the presence of someone who could really, really think straight. I was just sentiment and prejudices and emotions and whims and habits and indoctrination and attachments. And he was not. And he was just so smart. No matter what the subject was or what the issue was. And I just experienced that again and again. And because I was so... Because my life had been characterized by the fact that I gave the impression of having a superior intellect, but inside myself I knew I was a complete idiot and I didn't know anything. I mean, I didn't know what I really wanted to know, and what I did know seemed so useless to me. So I was always in this terror because I was in too many circumstances in which, you know, I seemed to have all this going on, but inside myself I knew I had nothing. One of the reasons I dropped out of school is that I got an A+ on the first paper I wrote, college, because I thought, these people don't know anything. Really, partly the teacher wasn't that good, but I thought, these people don't know anything, because I know that I don't know anything, and if I can come here and write and get the top grade right at the beginning, who's ever going to teach me anything? Do you see how that worked? In fact, the paper wasn't that good. The teacher wasn't that good. But it was fortuitous because it really put me right in that thought. And it was always a disturbance to me because I wanted wisdom and all I had was intelligence. And all I had was really school smarts. I didn't even have real intelligence. So I used to just wonder, what makes Swami so smart? And then I finally, it came to me very powerfully one day, because reason follows feeling. That's Master's words. Whatever you are prejudiced in favor of, you find reasons to support it. That's what Swami was talking about. And I want what I want. And I can only think within the parameters of my desires. Because outside of those desires is this very fearful turf. What if I don't get what I want? You know, what if this person I've married really turns out to be the wrong person for me? What if my desire to have a baby is never going to be fulfilled? What if my ambition to be a movie star is going to end in disaster? What if my hope of staying on the spiritual path is not really going to be fulfilled because I'm not playing the game correctly? I'm holding back. I mean, just make a long list. You know, I remember my dear mother, bless her heart. She died in her, I guess she must have been only 80. Yeah, she was about 80. And it was just about the last few weeks of her life. She'd had Parkinson's for 15 years. And she was not in great shape. She was primping in front of the mirror before we went out to lunch. No one would think I was 80, would they? She says like this. I mean, she looked every bit 80. But I said, no, Mother, of course they wouldn't. I mean, reason follows feeling. Mother, you look every bit 80, and besides, what difference does it make? But she wanted to see herself as young. No one would think I was 80. So I went along with it. What difference did it make? But just think how many things like that are true. But Swamiji would just cut to the heart of issue after issue after issue, and it was very simple because he wasn't afraid to know. And that his intelligence came from his heart. Because the heart, and this is where the Gita to talk about our verses, beware of attractions and repulsions. And in the Gita, it addresses this. They're not talking about ordinary likes and dislikes, which Swami describes as are more like annoying neighbors. But they're talking about real, you know, hatreds or infatuations. I mean, because Swamiji, just as an example, as he says himself, I'm a picky eater. I mean, he'll just only eat certain things and he won't eat other things and he likes this and he doesn't like that. But that doesn't really bind you to the world. What really binds you to the world is, well, the passionate thought, I have to be married to this person, I have to live in this place, I have to be respected in this way, I have to have the opportunity to express myself, or that person is so hideous, I just can't stand to be near them. You know, their vibrations are so bad, you know, and I just can't be in those places. Just all these, but strong feelings that are more than just conveniences. And where do they come from? Likes and dislikes are centered in the heart. That's where the citta is. That's where the bondage is. You're not bound. You're not bound merely by perceiving things as they are. You can say, that nightclub is really ugly and the music is awful and I don't want to be in there. That is just a fact. Could be just a simple fact. That's just a discrimination. But to become hysterical because you have to walk through it, or like Master, there was a story Swami tells of Master's life where they were out to dinner and somebody served them a meal with a little meat in it. And one person at the table just became so upset because there was meat on the table and how dare they serve us and I can't do this. And Master said, just push it aside. You know, just push it aside and eat the rest of it. It's not worth becoming so agitated about, even though he wasn't going to eat it, but it's not worth it. Remain calmer. But just calm the heart. Because when you calm the heart and are genuinely attuned simply to what is, fearlessly, then you can see what God wants you to do. The story that I told this in was the story about trying to understand God's will. And the lesson that I learned was the reason. So I was having so much trouble understanding God's will for me. And I said, it's so hard to know God's will. And Swami said, no, it's not. He said it just like that. No, it's not. You know, I was in this, you know, very early in my Sarah Bernhardt period. It's so hard to know what God's will, you know, just like this huge. He said, no, it's not. That was all he said to me. And then I really meditated on that issue. Because he didn't say it wasn't hard for him to know. He said, it's not hard to know. I mean, and people agonize over God's will all the time, don't they? That's because, in my case, it was just absolutely obvious to me, I did not want to know, because what my next step was going to break my heart, because I just had to leave behind people and things that I had never intended to leave behind, and I was going to have to leave them behind. I was going to have to go forward, and I just didn't want to, because I was in attraction and repulsion. Certain things were attractive, certain things were repulsive to me, and God's will was going to put me right through that. So my way of dealing with it was to be utterly dedicated to God's will, but in fact dedicated to a tract about this big in which God's will didn't happen to lie. So therefore, I could just spend all my time being hopelessly dedicated to God's will, because the likes and dislikes of the heart were actually ruling me. And I mean, Swami's just been unbelievable, except that I've witnessed it, in his absolute impartiality. When he stopped being a Swami in 1981, and he met this woman in Hawaii who he just felt that he felt that for the good of Ananda, he wasn't going to serve Ananda any longer at that point, being a monk, because it was supposed to be a householder community, and it was just not a householder community. Nobody could figure out how to be a spiritual householder. We had like 60 monks and nuns. Only a very small percentage of them were genuine monastics. Most of them just didn't know how to be householders and be spiritual, so they were trying to be monastics. It was becoming a very hypocritical community. People were not, they just didn't know how to move genuinely. We if I'm spiritual, I mean, you should be a monastic, so I'll be a monastic, and it just wasn't happening. And Swamiji really felt, he said, everything in this community has been defined by me. But they prayed to Master and said, you know, Master, I'm a monk. You made me a monk. How can I define the householder life? And he really felt Master didn't really say, well, you could marry for a while. And so Swami just, okay. And he was in Hawaii and he met this woman. And I mean, when I heard that Swami was, you know, not going to be a Swami anymore, that he met this woman and he was bringing her back, I said, no, couldn't happen. I mean, we all learned a lot that year. You know, one thing Swami also said is, you know, I was a little tired of the whole community having me in a box. He said, I'm not going to live in anybody's box. So he comes back with this woman who he declared was his life partner. She lasted about 8 months and then just went away, didn't come back. She lasted from February to Thanksgiving. By Thanksgiving, she was gone. And he had published in Yoga Journal, everything. He'd put aside his sannyas vows, and she was gone. And then he said afterwards, it was a very difficult period for Swami for this reason. He'd felt guided to be with her, and it hadn't worked out, and his concern was that he couldn't trust his guidance. So there was quite a few months where he was very inward. And then he realized that her presence, even for that short period of time, had accomplished what he was trying to accomplish. Because once Swamiji moved from a sense of inward guidance of what he really felt guided to do, rather than an outward sense of what looked right to do, even after all those years to repudiate his life as a sannyasi, just in front of everyone, and against all of our commands that he should follow our idea of what he should do, he just pushed it aside like that. But he saw that once Swamiji moved that way, it's like this whole exhalation happened in the community. Everyone went, oh, you know, maybe that's what the spiritual path really is. It isn't, because we were just becoming more and more, you know, full of what we ought to do and very little movement about what we really felt to do. And that's when monks and nuns, to a large extent, married each other and it turned into a householder community. I mean, that's how sometimes people tease Seva, who was our mother superior. Someone said, you know, you didn't teach these girls to cook very well. Seva said, I didn't know I was training them to be wives. She said, but a lot of the monastics married each other, and it's been the foundation of the community, because we were able to just shift all that understanding of renunciation into marriage. But it happened appropriately. It wasn't the wrong thing. It was just actually being able to stand back and say, what really feels like my life to me. Now, but the end point of all of this is that that's what brought, that's what just from night to morning, you know, Swami just saw, oh, it didn't work out the way I expected, but it worked out the way I wanted it to work out, the way God wanted. What I wanted to accomplish was accomplished, but by a different method than the one I thought. He thought it would be in partnership with this woman. He didn't think it was. And then not long after that, he met Rosanna Golia. And then he did marry her, and then they had a marriage that lasted 7 or 8 years. And it really, really put the community on a very firm foundation. What Rosanna brought in was an acceptance of children and families, because she was this very lovely, you know, warm-hearted woman, and she loved children, and it just sort of made families really a part of life at that point. But then it wasn't, Swami never saw it as a permanent life. And the life, again, she was not American. She moved into a situation that was so, where Swamiji had such an enormous worldwide life, it was a little bit of a challenge. So she decided to be something else, and they decided that. I feel slightly awkward dismissing it that easily, but it just turned, it turned out to be temporary instead of long-lasting. But it accomplished everything it was supposed to accomplish. I was really trying to speak back on the other side. All I was really going to say is when Thanksgiving came, and before it was even published in Yoga Journal, the woman was gone. So the big picture of Swamiji declaring this whole thing with this woman happens after she's already left because of the time lag. Swami said, this is what he said. If I chose to be, I could be quite embarrassed. He said, but I choose not to be. Just as simple as that. All the likes and dislikes of the heart that guide all of us, his only concern was for truth. He'd acted sincerely. Things had happened in a certain way. Every step of the way, he'd consulted his guidance and his relationship to Master. And if this was the result, you know, just so much courage, just not even a tinge of self-justification, just not even the slightest, not even a temptation. I mean, that was the most, just to point out that, you know, by any normal analysis, this is a very embarrassing situation. But why be embarrassed? We just follow the truth. And that's what freedom is. This is where, okay, the body is there, but the senses, the mind, how does he actually put it? It's way here at the end. The senses are superior to the body because the body goes along without any capacity, but then we can perceive the external world through our senses. But the mind is superior to the senses because the mind is what determines what the senses see. Whether, is it beautiful, is it ugly? This person we were looking at today, I thought he was obnoxious and incompetent. Someone else thought he was charming and enthusiastic. You know, and it was entirely based upon how the mind took exactly the same information. So the senses alone don't determine it. It's the mind that determines it. But then the discriminating intellect can sort of see all the different things that the mind says and then figure out what's really true of all its perceptions. So that discriminating intellect is more powerful than that. But the divine self is superior to everything. And so the Gita encourages us, and this is all the chapter on acting in the world. Okay, folks, we're going to be acting in the world, and we haven't by any means plumbed every verse here, but we're going to be acting in the world because it's our nature to do so. We're compelled to do so by our own nature. And let me just, we have this part. Everyone will act according to your own nature. Of what avail is suppression? It's a fantastic phrase. Swami describes it in the simplest way. He said Krishna was very, very practical. He was just practical. What he's saying is, look, what is. It's not going to do you any good to pretend it's not true. I don't really feel that way. I mean, I had to fight that battle a lot. I remember Swamiji, I went through this cycle with him where he gave me this job. I was running the publications company, and I was so incompetent, just unbelievably incompetent. And it was just a spiritual lesson for me. And Swamiji, and I had the characteristic of many incompetent people, which I couldn't admit that I didn't know anything and I didn't know how to ask for help. So he just kept putting more and more and more and more on me, none of which I could do, but all of which I said yes to and then did nothing about it. Went on for about a year. And inside, I was just so frantic and upset with him without being willing to admit it. And just, you know, shining on with this yes, sir. And finally, it just became impossible. And then he said to me, you never fooled me. You know, of course I never fooled. I mean, we don't fool each other. Haven't you ever worked with people who, you know what they feel, but they won't tell you what they feel? And so they're just saying, everything is fine. It's just fine. Are you sure you're fine? Yes, I'm just fine. You know perfectly well they're not fine, but they won't let you deal with it. And I went through that with Swami until I was really out of tune, really, really deeply out of tune, because I kept suppressing all this frustration with being asked to do what I didn't know how to do, but I didn't have the humility to learn. But I was incompetent. I couldn't transcend it just by pretending I wasn't. And I was angry at him. And I couldn't transcend it just by pretending I wasn't. You're not fooling me. You're not fooling yourself. You're not fooling God. You're not fooling your friends. I mean, Swami is very perceptive, but all your friends know when you're just shining them on. You just tie their hands when you do it. Well, first of all, I have this long-standing relationship with Swamiji. How are you, Asha? I don't know, sir. How am I? <You know? laughs> I mean, he's surprised me quite a few times. And then he'll articulate, and I'll realize, yeah, that's really true, isn't it? First of all, it just came to a head. You know, the pressure was so great. And then he fired me from the job, which was really a happy day. He fired me on a Friday. I said, why don't you really not explain to me why you're firing me until Monday, so for the whole weekend I can just be happy that I don't have to do this anymore. He said, okay. So for 2 days I was just so happy because I didn't have to face my failing and I didn't have to do that horrible job anymore. Then on Monday he talked to me, and so I got to be depressed for about a month. And how I got out of it was just trusting God through Swami a lot more, that of what avail is suppression? What good does it do not to deal with what's actually happening? You know, I look back on it now. I was 25, 26 years old. I was just so immature. I look back on it now. If I just said, okay, Swamiji, you want me to do X, Y, and Z, but I don't really know how to do it. What do you suggest I do? I mean, that was all I had to say. But that would have admitted all these things that I didn't want to face. So I was just pushing them back. You know, the mind, reason follows feeling. It was just completely dumb, but at the time it seemed like a good idea. What can you say? But Krishna says it doesn't do any good to pretend anything. Just accept what is. And then they talk about the different gunas and how they act. This is the mirror and the rust and the smoke on the fire. You know, some karma is like smoke obscuring fire. And if smoke obscures fire, you go like that. And the smoke blows away and the fire is clear. Sometimes it's dust, they say here. Sometimes they say rust on a mirror. Let's say dust on a mirror. You have to clean it. But if you just, you know, it's a little harder than just blowing on the smoke. But you can clean it off and then it shines. And some karma, misunderstanding, ignorance, is like the embryo in the womb. You can't say, I think I'll have this baby in 3 months. You know, and you can't, you know, do all this extra stuff and work hard to have the baby in 3 months. It just takes 9 months. And there's just nothing you can do. You just have to live through it until it goes away, until you've come to term and it's finished itself. So that's what Krishna's saying. Look, whatever karmas you have, you just have. And some of them you can get away with a little bit of effort. Some will take a lot more, and some you just have to outlast. I was talking to a friend just this morning about, you know, all of us have, we carry so much from past lives, and all of us have karmic themes that we're following out. And I was talking to her about a particular karmic theme I have, which I have now, just after 40 years, I've isolated it down, so I no longer have much belief in its external reality. For 30 of the last 40 years, I thought it was actually happening out there. I thought people were actually doing things to me. Now I have isolated it down to a feeling that's just right here. It's just a whirlpool of feeling right here, and it's a filter every so often that goes over my mind that causes me to see the world in a certain way. But it does exist, though. It's still very, very real. It's just think how many lives end with unresolved issues. I mean, just imagine it. You know, in this new book that Master's coming out, we're just going to go without a break because we're almost at the end of the time anyway. you might have guessed by now. Master, in this book about relationships, this that is going to come out next, Master talks about spiritualizing relationships. That's the name of the book after the karma and reincarnation and the how to be happy all the time, Master's teachings. Then there's the section about jealousy and marriage, and then he's also talking about infidelity in marriage. And he gives the woman advice, if your husband is unfaithful, this is how you should respond. Then she's talking to the man, if the woman is unfaithful, and this is what he says, nothing will be served by shooting her. And he talks a little bit about really why it really doesn't help any just to shoot her. As if like that was going to be the response. And you know, Ananda found that. Ananda gathers all this, and Master talks at length about advising men not to shoot their unfaithful wives in a jealous rage. I mean, a lot of men shoot their wives, and maybe nobody in this room recently. But I mean, a lot of the murder of women is how it happens. Many more murders happen among people who are close to each other than strangers. That's who shoots each other. So Master just calmly explains why it won't serve anything to shoot your wife. But it's an example of what if you are the unfaithful wife and your husband shoots you? What if you're the husband who shoots his unfaithful wife, then shoots himself? Or, you know, just what a mess. And then everybody dies. And then when you meet each other the next time, you don't remember any of that. You just have this very peculiar response to one another. That's also the story, yeah, that's also, Swami tells the story about this couple who wanted Master to marry him, and Master said, I won't marry you, and I advise you not to marry each other. He said, just do me a favor. He said, don't kill each other. And then they just huffed out, and they were, come dear, we're not going to have anything to do with this so-called spiritual man. And then they did get married, and after a relatively short time, they came back to Master and said, we had no idea what lay within us individually and what lay between us. They said actually the only thing that saved us from killing each other was your having said that. But you think about how many times you're smashed up in an automobile. You see these stories of somebody who's careless on the road and kills everybody in his car. Some teenager who was making cell phone calls and the whole car smashes. Somebody's speeding and hits the couple walking on the side of the road, boom, everybody's out of their body. And then the next time they come together, but it's all there. Where do you think it is? It's all in your chakras. Nidruva and I, Sheila and I, used to have lunch together a lot when she lived here and she was working on the lawsuit, and I'd have lunch with her. We were very dear friends, and she had these plates, these sort of heavy pottery plates. They were nice, but they were sort of heavy. And we were sitting at the table, and her table was just a little high for both of us. And this was what we were both talking about, the fact that even though we knew we were going to eat everything that we had cooked for lunch, we left a little in the pot so that after we cleaned our plate, we could go get a little more. You know how girls, all the girls know how girls talk about these things. And just in that moment, we both shrank to being about 6 years old. And we were tiny little hungry orphans together somewhere. And we had been so hungry, you know, for so long, that just knowing there was more in the pot just meant so much to both of us. I mean, it practically brought tears to both our eyes. It was just right there. It makes me almost cry right now. It was so real. You know, that's what you have. You can't just say, oh, I shouldn't feel that way. I don't want to feel this way. You do. We were so hungry for so long, so we always kept a little in the pot. And it would make us just so unreasonably happy to go there and get the second helping. And we had there were these big pottery plates, you know, and the food looked really small on the plate. And Sheila has that, you know, her hair is cut like Brenda's, real short. She's African-American. She just looks so little, you know, with that little shaved head. I think they must have shaved her head because of the lice in that orphanage, you know. But that's who we are. You think you can just sort of brush those things aside? Don't kid yourselves. You have to be tough against it. You have to be very discriminating. You have to cling to the divine self with all your heart. But it won't do you any good to pretend it's not happening. Some of it you can just go, oh, that's silly. I don't have to feel that way. Some of it you work and you work and you clean it off. Some of it you just have to outlast. That's what Swami was talking about on Sunday. You must feel that there is no choice but the spiritual path, because it's not always going to be a happy experience. It's not merely that you have to be blissfully drawn to God. You have to absolutely know there is no choice. And the worst of it is realizing who you are inside. Swamiji said so many people came to Master and left. And the reason they left is because in his presence, in the presence of so much illumination, people actually saw themselves clearly and realized what they were going to have to do to get free. And rather than face that, they ran away from the light, thinking that once I'm out of the light, it won't be there anymore because I won't see it. And Master, that's what Mr. Quaron, Swami told that story so sweetly. Master said to Mr. Quaron, I lost sight of you for a few lifetimes, but I'm not going to lose sight of you anymore. And then Mr. Quaron would often say to Master, remember your promise. The Master said, I remember. Well, there's probably nothing to say beyond that, so that's the end of tonight. Just let it be. All right. God bless you.